All right, so let's do today Torah and Tea. We started a new book, the Book of Devarim. And today, we're going to first study a little bit about the Sicha in Volume 19, the fifth Sicha for the portion of Devarim. And in Volume 24, the first Sicha for the portion of Devarim. Now, the first Sicha is a very technical Sicha. I just want to share with you some of the story brought down. You know, there is something about the rabbis instituted that even food that is kosher, so that it's 100% kosher, but if it was cooked by someone not Jewish, it's called bishul akum, cooked by somebody non-Jewish. And then the rabbis instituted that we shouldn't eat that also. The reason is the rabbis were afraid that becoming too intimate and too friendly with the neighbors around you might bring you to learn from their ways. And the Chachamim wanted to protect you so from the ways of the non-Jews, so they said that you should not eat the food, the bishul akum. And it is also connected to our pasuk, because there is a hint in our parsha which implies that the food that was cooked, bishul akum, is not to be consumed. The Rebbe has a very interesting discussion, but I just want to bring out, there's an interesting story that took place in the Talmud that the Rebbe quotes over there, and bring out a lesson from that story that the Rebbe brings out. So the Gemara says there was two people. One person's name was Mr. Yehuda, or Mar Yehuda. Exactly who this Mr. Yehuda was is not so clear, but it may even be referencing one of the great Tanoim, Rabbi Yehuda. In this case, he's referred to as Mar Yehuda. There was another fellow, he was a Jewish fellow too, but his name was Bati. His name was Bati Bar Tuvi. Bati, the son of Tuvi. Okay, now, these two Jewish men, one was Mr. Yehuda, or Rabbi Yehuda, but the Gemara calls him Mar Yehuda, and the other one was Bati Bar Tuvi. They were sitting in front of the Shvor Malko. He was the king at the time, and he invited these two Jews to be at his table. So they bring before them an esrog. You know, today it's a kind of a lemon, but I guess that was supposed to be some kind of a delicacy that they ate in the homes of the king. So they brought before them as a snack, as a dessert, or what have you, they brought before them an esrog. Does it exactly mean the esrog that we use today when we do the bracha on the four species, or on the lulav and the esrog, or it's some other citrus that's called an esrog? I'm not sure, but no matter what, they brought an esrog. So what happened? Posak. So the king cuts a piece, ochal, and he ate himself. He caught himself off a piece from that esrog and he ate it. And then Posak Vahavle Lebati Bartuvi. Then he cut up another piece and he gave it to this Bati Bartuvi. He gave him another piece of the Esrog. Okay, so that's what he did. So he gave himself a piece, and he gave this Bati Bartuvi a piece. And then he went and he took the knife that he cut the Esrog with, and he put it 10 times into the ground. The Gemara talks over there that when you have a knife that may have absorbed, and you're using it cold, not regular, but it may have absorbed from non-kosher food, and you use it for cold, you can stick it 10 times into the ground. That sort of wipes away and removes the upper layer or the upper shell to clean it off a little bit so that you can use it. So this Shver Malka went and stuck that knife. Now, presumably that was to get rid of the non-kosher status of that knife. Posak Havle Lamar Yehuda, and he cut off another piece, and then he gave to Mr. Yehuda a piece of that esrog. Seemingly, he didn't want to give him with the non-kosher knife. So the Shver Malka went and he cut the piece himself so that he can give him his food with a kosher knife, because he koshered it in between. So now, this Bati, who is Jewish too, so Bati Bartuvi speaks up and he says, "What about me?" He says, "I'm not Jewish. Why did you, when you cut me the piece of Esrog, you didn't stick the knife first in the ground? How come you only did it for this Mr. Yehuda, for this Mar Yehuda?" So the Gemara says that, so what he answered him, we have two versions of what he answered him. According to one version, he says, "Look, I knew about this Mar Yehuda, that he's a very religious man. And I knew that he was not going to eat the fruit if I cut it with a non-kosher knife. So, because I knew that, so that's why I koshered it. But about you, I'm not sure. I don't know how religious you are. I'm not sure how religious you are or not." Okay, so the Rebbe asks on this, what does it mean? What does it mean? So if you're not sure if he's religious or not, I mean, so why do you give him with a non-kosher? Why do you give him with a non-kosher knife? Maybe he is religious, maybe he's not. What kind of a reason is it? Doesn't seem like to be a strong enough reason. We'll see in a minute. There's another version that the king told him something even worse. The king told him, "Remember," he says, "what you did last night." The king told him. And as Rashi explained, that the Persians used to provide their guests with women, and he offered it to Mr. Yehuda, who didn't accept it, but this Bati accepted it. So he says, "I know you're not so religious already, so that's why I didn't bother giving you a kosher knife." And the Rebbe asks, it's a little bit surprising, but what has it got to do one with the other? Maybe he failed that test, and maybe he still wants to eat kosher, you know? Maybe, how do we know? Why would he give him non-kosher, even if he had the right to? The Rebbe learns that here wasn't the issue of kosher and not kosher. Here the issue was that this knife was used was used with food that was cooked by a non-Jewish person, which, according to many halachic views, that would even render like the pot not kosher. For example, you would have to kosher the pot. In this case, you would have to kosher the knife because it was used by being cooked by Bishul Akum. And the Rebbe explains like this, very interesting. He brings out from the Tosis. This Bati wasn't really yet a full Jew. Even though he says, I'm not Jewish. He used to be a slave and he was freed and he wasn't fully. So he didn't really have, they had, and the Rebbe brings out, it's a long explanation, but the Rebbe said, they had a real excuse to eat. I want to bring out the lesson. They had a real excuse to eat it. Look, when you're sitting at the king's table, and the king cuts you a piece of fruit and offers it to you, I don't care how religious you are, you don't refuse the king, because that would be a disrespect for the king. And you might cost you your life. And a person is not supposed to give up his life to eat kosher or to eat Bishul Akum. It's okay. So this Bati Bar Tuvi did not really have an obligation when the king offered him, and the king knew that in his presence you don't refuse a king. He knew that he was supposed to eat it. And he's not supposed to keep the halachas of worrying about whether it's kosher, what kind of knife was used for it. You don't refuse the king. But Mar Yehuda, he didn't care. He would not eat with a not kosher knife, even in a case where it endangered his life. So when the king is saying to him, he's saying that, you know, I don't know about you whether, if you're crazy, if you're, I don't say crazy, but I mean, if you're ultra, ultra religious, that you're going to take a chance to refuse the king. I would think that most people, when it comes to a situation, in an uncomfortable situation, or sometimes in a situation in which, you know, you might be disrespectful to the king, maybe in those cases, you're not going to keep the laws. You're going to say, listen, you know, a lot of times people, when they're put into uncomfortable positions, maybe they'll compromise on their principles or on their religious, on their beliefs or on their practice, what they do, because they're uncomfortable. So basically, Bati had a legitimate reason not to keep the laws. He could eat from the king because that would be a disrespect for the king. It could cost him his life. But he argued, the king says, I know this Mar Yehuda. He's so ultra religious, he's fanatically religious, that even in the presence of the king, he is not going to not going to eat it. So I had no choice. I wanted him to eat it, so I had to do it. And the Rebbe says that this is like a very big lesson for us, that, you know, a lot of times people feel when they compromise. There's a story told about, I forget the name, but it was a queen, I mean, we're talking about, you know, a few hundred years ago, I forget, with a famous rabbi. He went to visit the queen. And it was a dilemma because the rabbi would not shake any other woman's hand. And it was like a big issue. What are we going to do? If the queen is going to stretch out her hand, and the rabbi is not going to take it, it'll be very offensive to the queen. And when he passed by the queen, he told the queen that we only touch that which belongs to us. He says something which is not ours, something that belonged to me, we don't touch. The queen was so impressed with his answer. You know, her husband was not such a, and she turns to him, you see, this guy will not even touch something which doesn't belong to him, besides his wife, he won't touch. And you go and you do all kinds of other stuff, you know, hanky-panky stuff. He says, you know, the Rebbe learns a lesson. The Rebbe doesn't bring down the story. The Rebbe learns a lesson that when you stay strong, and in this case, look, it's not that the king sent like somebody else. He had plenty of servants. Why does the king have to go ahead and use the knife and stick it in himself in the ground? That's not honorable for the king. He should get a servant to do this work for him. But this goes and shows us that when you're proud and when you're strong and you really mean what you say and that your religious beliefs are very strong, then even the powerful king gets tremendous amount of respect for you. Not only that, he actually helps you. He does the work for you. The Rebbe always said that if the people in the leadership in Israel would talk with openly and with a sense of being secure in what they say and really believing in their rights to Eretz Yisrael, to Israel, and to really come across as, you know, this is not negotiable, this is not, we're not giving away something which is our only place and inheritance, that we are here because God gave us the land to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. We've been there throughout the history. If we would say so clearly, people would listen to us and they would respect us more rather than always trying to flatter or always trying to find excuses and compromise, constantly to try to find favor. Oh, you're not going to say something they're not going to like, and maybe they're going to judge you or they're going to treat you not. That's not the way to earn the respect. The Rebbe says, look at this story over here. The way you got the respect from the king was specifically when he saw that a Jewish person was standing on his beliefs, is not compromising. I know him that he will not eat what's not kosher, then the king isn't going to serve him anything that's not kosher. The king is going to respect that. And then the other person who doesn't care about his being kosher, the king said, go ahead, I'll give you non-kosher. You don't have to eat. So the Rebbe says people have to be proud. People have to be strong. People have to be open and not be ashamed of who and what we are. You know, some people are embarrassed to wear a yarmulke. Because why? Because people look at me strange. Some people, but you know what? You don't have to feel that way. And we actually gain more respect if we declare a way out without hiding. And that's something, if we do it, we will earn the respect and the will help us not only not criticize. That's one point of the first Sicha. In the other one, we started the portion of Devarim. And let me first, before we do that, tonight is actually Rosh Chodesh Av, the beginning of the 9 days. The reminder people that want to wear new clothes on the 9 days, they have to try on everything, not only new, even washed clothing. They should try everything on before the 9 days begin. And then we start that we don't have any wine, and we don't have any meat during the 9 days till Tisha B'Av. It all started with Rosh Chodesh. The beginning of the month, several steps, how much the mourning takes hold. So we have the 3 weeks, then we have Rosh Chodesh, the 9 days. Then we have the week of Tisha B'Av. We have the 7th day of Menachem Av. And then, of course, we have Tisha B'Av, and then the 10th of Av. So we have all these different stages. And Rosh Chodesh is the beginning of the month, but we have the, as we learned any time, we have the power. Rosh Chodesh Av is also mentioned as the day that Aaron passed away. The Torah actually mentions it two times in the Parsha. It gives us the date of Aaron's passing. That was on Rosh Chodesh Av. And we know that one of the main characteristics that Aaron was remembered for was the fact that he was a person that loved peace, and he would seek peace, and he would, as the Mishnah says, be of the students of Aaron, Ohev Shalom, Verodev Shalom. Love peace and seek, go after, try peace. We know that when Aaron passed away on Rosh Chodesh Av, the whole Jewish community mourned, and actually all of the men and the women mourned more than the mourning even for Moshe Rabbeinu. As Rashi points out, that Aaron would make peace between husband and wife, between neighbor and neighbor. He would always work hard to have people reconcile, work it out, and work together. So that's the special characteristic from Aaron. So Aaron's at his yahrzeit, as we know, yahrzeit is the time when everything that the person worked for is elevated. And we know that this is actually the reason, one of the reasons given why the second Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, was because there was no love between people. There was actually senseless hatred. You know, sometimes people hate each other for a reason. Maybe somebody did something to you, so you hate him, or somebody insulted you. Sometimes there is senseless hatred, which means there's not even a reason for it. You know, you just are. That's sinas chinom. That's called sinas chinom. That's senseless. There's no reason. And how is the way to get the Beis HaMikdash back? That was the reason why it was destroyed, is by practicing what Aaron, and that's sort of very telling that Aaron's passing is on this day. What he personified is because he tells us the way to correct this this behavior, instead of sinas chinam, to have ahavas chinam, senseless love. What would be senseless love? Sometimes you love the other person because they did something for you, or they gave you something. But senseless love means without a reason. You just love the other person because he is just another person. You have him, Abbas Yisrael, just plain for no reason. That's the way to increase. And that means if you have a fellow Jew, a fellow Yid, where you don't even know who he is, and to care about him and to reach out to them, to help them, that's called Ahavas Chinam. So that's the way to get back on Rosh Chodesh Av, when the 9 days, when we mourn the Beis HaMikdash, we have the recipe, we have the ingredients, and we know how to bring it back. That is by practicing Ahavas Chinam, this senseless love, to reach out and to try to be helpful. For certainly not to speak Lashon Hara, not to say mean things, not to do things that are hurtful and things like that, because we're trying to build the Beis HaMikdash. And learning the Beis HaMikdash and studying, and all this is part of building the Beis HaMikdash. Let's learn a little bit in the second Sicha. We have another interesting discussion. In the Parsha, it says, Moshe Rabbeinu begins. So this is verse number 5. It says that Moshe began to explain the Torah. Moshe explained it. What does it mean, explain the Torah? How did he explain to them? Rashi brings down from our sages, it says he explained it to them, meaning 70 languages. That he explained the Torah in 70 languages. Now, seems like the Torah at that time was interpreted in all 70 languages. I don't think that English was around at that point yet, so I don't know if it was explained in English, but I guess the 70 nations, each nation had its own language, and therefore that was the 70 languages that Moshe explained it. But what does it seem to tell us? It seems to say that explaining the Torah in all languages is actually a good thing. It's preferable. That's what Moshe Rabbeinu did. Not only that, he says later on, he told them when they're going to pass the Jordan, and on the other side, they should actually write the Torah in 70 languages. It seems like interpreting the Torah, translating the Torah, making it accessible is a very positive matter. And the Rebbe asks that it seems like we have a contradiction to this idea. And the Rebbe quotes from Mesechtes Sofrim, which is also brought down partially in the Gemara. Over there it says, over here we were talking about, it was another king, talking about kings. Here we're talking about Shvur Malka. Now we're talking about Talmai HaMelech. He was a Greek. He was a king of the Greek. And there were 5 elders, and they wrote the Torah in Greek for him. But the Gemara, this Mesechta Sofrim, they say this was not, it was a very, very difficult day for the Jewish people. It was so difficult, just as the day that the golden calf was made. Wow. It wasn't just a difficult day, but it was as difficult as the day the golden calf was made. And it says the reason. The reason is because you could not really fully translate it. It's not really fully translatable. What does this mean? You can't really fully translate it. And why are we equating it to the day that the egel was made? And why don't we say, oh, it's like making the egel? Why we're saying like the day the egel was made? And the Rebbe points out that there is also another case, you know, we know all the time, another case where we use like the same language, that it's so difficult as the day the egel was made. And that's in another section in the Talmud. You know, usually the halacha remains like Hillel or Beis Hillel against Beis Shammai. We have the two study houses, the study of Hillel, the house of Hillel, and we have the house of Shammai. The law is always like Hillel against Shammai. How did they determine who the law is like? Because they used to make a vote. It was fair and square. They used to make a vote, and the rabbis would vote. So they say, who holds like Hillel? Who holds like Shammai? Usually Beis Hillel would always win. There were more people. That's why the law was established like Beis Hillel. There happened one time, there were more people of Beis Shammai than Beis Hillel. And on that day, they ended up doing several rules the way Shammai wanted it. And the Gemara says also over there that Hillel was sitting in front of Shammai like one of the students. He was like you know, everything went like Shammai went, and they didn't listen to Hillel at that time. And the Gemara says also that day was as difficult as the day they made the Egel. Again, what's the equation to the day they made the Egel? So quickly, the Rebbe brings out an idea that sometimes what you're doing now isn't really so bad, but it has a bad consequence later on. The Rebbe talks about the Egel, for example. The Jewish people made the Egel, right? But then Aaron said to them, the festival would be tomorrow. He tried to push them off. He said, Chag LaHashem Machar. Tomorrow is the festival for Hashem. Aaron was hoping that when Moshe Rabbeinu will come down, we're going to celebrate Moshe Rabbeinu's descent. There's going to be no more Egel, it's going to be a festival. Matter of fact, it's brought down in the Kisvei Arizal that there is a festival going to be on the next day, which is Shivasar B'Tammuz. The day that Moshe Rabbeinu descended is Shivasar B'Tammuz, and that day is going to be a festival, but not at that time, in the future, because all the fast days will be turned into holidays. So it'll actually be eventually Mochar Lachazman. But anyways, the point here is like this. Sometimes what we do today doesn't necessarily mean that it's bad right now. From what's happening now, something bad will come out in the future. Sort of as when the Egel was made. When the Egel was made, the bad did not happen yet. The bad happened the next day when they worshipped, when they said, Eila Elokecha Elecha Yisrael, this is your God, that when they worshipped the Egel. When Hillel was sitting in front of Shammai, in that particular instance, that wasn't the end of the world. Why? They had the majority, that was good. The problem was, people will learn from this later on. And what's going to happen is, people might conclude that, you know, the law is not like Hillel, because look, Hillel is sitting in front of Shammai. So the consequence of this, it's like the day the Egel was made, the consequence came out bad, even though that act wasn't yet the end of the world. What's going to come from that? The problem why you can't translate the Torah correctly, he says you can't translate it correctly, is, as for example, the Talmud brings down a whole bunch of things, but I'll say one. Like, it says like this, what Talmai did, that's from the Talmud, another, he got 72 elders, and he put them in their own house. He told them, each one, you translate the Torah for me. And they all changed the Torah exactly in the same words. So, what did they say? Like, Bereishis bara Elokim. What does it mean in the beginning? When God created. They changed it around in the translation. They wrote Elokim bara Bereishis. Why? Because he said there's going to be a mistake. If we translate it literally, they're going to say Bereishis is the name that the Bereishis created Elokim. So there's a God that created the God. They're going to make a mistake. So they switched it around to say Elokim bara Bereishis. When it means that you can't translate the Torah fully, means if you translate it literally, it's going to lead, it may lead eventually to a mistake. So which means that because it cannot be translated literally, even though now it doesn't necessarily mean, but the problem may happen later on. That's why we equate this to the day that the Egel was made. Not to making of the Egel, not to worshiping the Egel, but today, from there, something wrong will come out. We always need to know, a lot of times we do things, and maybe we have a justification for what we do. Maybe that's the right thing for that moment for us to do. But we always have to remember there's a lot of eyes looking at us, and there's some people that come to conclusions based on what they see. So the next day, like we learned in the Mishnah, Chachomim Hizoru B'Divreichem, the sages, be careful what you say, because somebody might misunderstand, and they're not misinterpreted, and then they will cause a tremendous upsetness and a lot of problems. You have to act in a way that people should not misinterpret. So sometimes for Hillel to sit before Shammai in a way of subdued, that wasn't the end of the world, but people might conclude that Shammai is greater than Hillel, and then they were going to come and rule according to that. That's a difficulty. I mean, there was no choice over there. I'm just giving this as an example. But it means to say that our words, our actions, our behavior has consequences to it. And a lot of times, even if you have not intended for that, you don't mean that, but it leaves it open for misinterpretation for other people. So certainly, when we talk about reaching out to people, loving people, we talk about Ahavas Chinam, having senseless love, I have called that just like that. You have to always, you know, sometimes it's necessary to do something which is strong, which may be interpreted, but we also always have to be conscientious about what our words and what our actions and what they may mean to others. And then sometimes, like, we don't have a choice, you know, like the story with Hillel, with the story with Talmai HaMelech, you know, the day they go, sometimes it happens. But that is something to be careful about, and that's the extent we should try to do in the way that.